Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Good afternoon and happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank. And yes, welcome to my last show from the road. Because although I am here in the studio today...
I was going to say, you're not on the road.
Somewhere in my heart, I'm on the road. I feel like we need to add to my intro, Road Warrior. Because since I've gotten home, I have dreams of getting in the car and starting it up and just driving. It's like my body's still in motion. 8,000 miles across the country and back. It's been phenomenal. But although I'm here today in spirit and in body, my conversations today are actually going to come to you from the Catskills of New York, Frenchwoods Festival of the Performing Arts, to be exact, and also from the Goodspeed Opera House in East Haddam, Connecticut, where I'll be having a conversation with Christine Zbornik. So we won't be taking calls today. We're going to do things a little differently, but you can always be a part of the show or be in contact with us through our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can check out photos from my trip across the country or leave comments on our Facebook page. But you can also follow us on our Instagram at The Reluctant Therapist. And you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. And then if you'd like to subscribe to our podcast or podcast the show on your device to listen at your convenience, you can find us on iTunes. Make sure you search for A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. So part of my motivation for doing this long solo drive, and there were a lot of reasons why I wanted to do this long solo drive to the East Coast, but one of the big pulls was a chance to get to visit with my daughter, Kelly, who's spending this summer working as a counselor at Frenchwoods Festival of the Performing Arts in Hancock, New York. And so I haven't seen her for quite a while, and I was excited to get up there and get to spend some time with her and to see this beautiful place, this camp that sits along a private lake with trees and greenery and open space and phenomenal facilities. I mean, I knew Frenchwoods was special because of its location and its activities and its reputation as a premier camp. But what struck me about the camp was what an incredibly beautiful model this community is for what world peace and harmony could actually look like if we were able to make it happen. Because I arrived for my first visit on the 4th of July, and I was there just in time for the camp-wide patriotic program. Now, you have to imagine the scene. We're in this huge arena, their circus arena, because they do a full circus. They have circus activities for the kids there, and, you know, flying trapeze and swinging from the top of the rafters. I mean, it's incredible. So we're in this huge arena, 800 campers, about 400 staff members, and everyone's enjoying the music of a full orchestra formally set up in the middle of the arena with an orchestra conductor in his full tux. And the orchestra itself is made up of staff members who are all incredible musicians and campers themselves. I mean, imagine, it's quite a feat to get 1,000 people of any age to be quiet and respectful at any kind of event, but to get kids 7 to 17 to be engaged, listening full-heartedly to an orchestra playing patriotic music, that's something that you have to see to believe. I mean, it's incredible how quiet and respectful they were and supportive. And there are kids and counselors from 18 different countries that come up to Frenchwoods every summer. So it's like a miniature United Nations every summer sitting in this big arena. And so part of the patriotic program was to play the national anthem from each of the different countries, you know, snippets of it. And so I watched the kids, when they heard parts of their country's national anthem start to play, jump up, and they all had flags of their country, or they'd made signs and they'd stand up proudly, and everyone else in the arena was so respectful and cheering for them, and just you could feel the love and support and just how much they honored each other. It's just an incredible mix of, I don't know, it's love and joy. And I was completely emotional. I'm getting choked up now thinking about it, because when they got to the United States national anthem, the entire arena erupted. everyone was singing along at the top of their lungs, which you never hear at any sort of sporting event on a day-to-day basis. I mean, the whole room was singing. It was unrehearsed. It was completely spontaneous. Everyone was just hearing the spirit. I mean, really, you just have to hear it to understand what I was experiencing in the moment. So, I don't know, that gives me an incredibly great feeling and sense of hope for the future, just hearing all those young voices and seeing their excitement and enthusiasm. And it's not what I imagine summer camp to be, believe me. This place is unlike what I picture when I think of summer camp, because it revolves around the performing arts, but it also includes all sorts of other activities. And I just kept thinking, gosh, if we could get all children together in this way in a safe and supportive community and let them just be together day after day, they'd figure everything else out. They'd get us to where we needed to be. Bringing them all together, these kids don't focus on their differences. They focus on connecting. They focus on all the ways that they're alike and things that they're interested together. And, you know, maybe this is just a unique place. Maybe it's the people, the roots of the performing arts that make it all work at one time. But maybe it's really the vision of the people who've kept French Woods running summer after summer since 1970. The same family has been coming together each year, bringing back staff members who return year after year, because it's become their family, their camp family. And so I was excited to get a chance to talk to two of the members of the French Woods leadership about their experience working at camp and what brings them back year after year. Because really, it has to be something about this magical staff that creates this environment. The challenge, of course, was finding time to talk to anyone in leadership during their incredibly busy days, because they're basically running a city of 1,400, 1,500 people each day and all that goes into it. And you wouldn't know how many people are there because it runs so seamlessly. So it took me 3 or 4 visits. I went up and visited Kelly on a number of occasions over the course of my visit back east. And it was finally on my last time up to see her that I was able to get some time to talk to Isaac. But it took a little while. He kept having to go on from one minor camp emergency to another. So I turned my conversation to head counselor Carolyn Stock Chapin and asked her what makes French Woods so special and what's kept her coming back to camp for 17 years.
No, it's a community. It's working. I work with the CITs, a counselor in training, and the oldest kids. And so that, for me, being able to make a little difference in the teenager's life. And, I'm a teacher during the year, so it's having a different hat on and working, you know, as a counselor, a big sister, a mom, a friend, an ear, helping them to push themselves outside a box and grow through the summer, personally, musically, you know, whatever they're doing. It's great. It's an inspiring place, because you see kids come knowing things and growing, and you see kids trying new things they've never tried before. My husband's here too. And
did you meet him here?
No, yeah. He proposed to me here because he knew it was my favorite place in the world. So he came and flew in and proposed. But he runs the rock and roll program he has for the last 9 years, I think, or 8 years, and our two daughters are here. They're 5 and 7, and they're born here. Yeah. So now I see through the perspective or the eyes of as a parent too, and how much my kids grow and how their teachers, when we come back, always say these amazing things about, oh, they're so much more socialized and aware, and can negotiate any situation just from being at camp. It's a lot of lessons that just keep on going through the year. It's really great. Yeah.
So what do you think the camp experience does for kids who are struggling with mental health issues at home, do you see the symptoms disappear here?
Yeah, I mean, they're allowed to be here at camp and be in that moment and that bubble. The stressors of maybe everyday life are not here, and so it allows them to just embrace doing camp. And it's a highly structured place, but it's also a place where they have control over their schedule, and so it, that mix, I think, allows them to be able to let go of, I mean, the issues may still be there, it's always there, but it doesn't take over their life here. And it's something where, you know, Isaac always says, or, you know, we embrace differences, and so it's a place where kids that may be struggling socially at home don't struggle as much here, because everybody's special, everyone's different, and that's okay. And so there's not that pressure to put on a mask or be someone else. They can just be themselves, and it's a healthy and safe place for them to do that, an environment where some of the stressors of outside life aren't there. And, yeah, but no, I think it's a very encouraging place for kids that are having any kind of issues, whether it's physical or mental. We had a kid here last session with cerebral palsy, and we watched her get on a horse and go swimming and fly on the trapeze, and, you know, and it was great. And we made a couple of adjustments to make it work, but that made it even more special.
So. Are you the only camp that does circus?
No, but we were the only camp that did circus back in the 80s, but yeah. Now a lot of camps have flying trapeze, but nobody has what we have. Yeah. We do a circus performance with 60 different activities available. We do the shows with live bands, which is, so many kids are so involved, you know, with the bands and the performers, and there's nothing like it.
No, some kids think that being, you know, if you say to a parent, oh, we have a circus, they think clowns, yes, and, you know, juggling, where it's much more Cirque du Soleil based, and it's all these aerial acts and all these amazing things that I never even knew what they were called before I came here. And then, yeah, the kids are all in these bands, so there's live groups that are playing the music as well for a huge audience. I think that's one of the most unique things about the place.
Even magic, sure. When you think of magic, you think about learning a trick. It's theater-based magic, where it's a performance art, you know, and it's got a stage manager and lighting and the sound, and it's you know, also an incredible performance. So besides learning the magic, you learn that stage presence. And so,
well, and in a time we're so focused on STEM, which doesn't have the A, no arts, this seems almost like one of the few places that these kids are going to get an opportunity to explore these.
We like to call it STREAM.
Okay, tell me, what's this R? What's the STREAM?
Recreation and arts.
I like the STREAM. STEAM I've heard, but not STREAM. Listening to Public Radio KCBX, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. If you're just tuning in, I'm bringing to you one of my last shows from the road, and I had a chance to visit Frenchwoods Festival of the Performing Arts in Hancock, New York, this summer, and have a conversation with Isaac Baumfeld and Carolyn Stock-Chapin. Isaac is the camp director, and he's been there for the better part of his adult life, and he is a busy man all day long, you know, seeing behind the scenes, meeting with the kids, talking to them about their day. One of the things I found incredible is that there are 800 campers each session, and yet Isaac seems to know almost all of them by name, and they have some special connection to him, and it's an incredible gift. And I think, again, as I said, it's the spirit of the staff and the people who brought Frenchwoods together that creates this loving, supportive community, and you can sense it. And so I finally got a little time to talk with Isaac alone. We jumped in his gator. There's a lot of them driving around all over the property every day, and we got a chance to talk a little bit as we drove down to visit one of the theaters on site. So can you start off talking a little bit about the history of camping in the Catskills, like these summer camps? How did they come to be?
I think it started over 100 years ago. It's like a Jewish phenomenon from the immigrants that came here after, you know, back 100 years ago, and even after World War II, it became a big thing for the kids to go away for the summer, to get out of the city. And Frenchwoods grew into its own special, unique place, because most traditional camps are sports-oriented, outdoors-oriented, and it's in 1970 or 71 when this started, It was very unique in that it wasn't for a whole summer. You can come for 3 weeks at a time. And it was the first camp, really, that had individualized program where the kids chose the things that they wanted to do rather than have a program where they all went together. So it's kind of like a microcosm of real life.
Because so,
in real life, you know, you get up in the morning with your parents, you have breakfast, and you go to school, and the kids go to school, the parents go to work. Here they get up, they have breakfast, their counselors go to work, and they go to their activities. So the bunk becomes a family, and it's very important to them. Kids come here for the activities, but stay here because of the friends and the staff.
So what? How long have you been at French Woods, and what brought you here?
Since 81, 36 summers, 35 years. What brought me here is I wanted my children to be exposed to the arts, and I found French Woods back in 1980. And the first summer I didn't even come here because they didn't have the job I wanted. So I went somewhere else, but then wound up back here. And I've been with French Woods since. But my kids, my son's an incredible athlete, but French Woods taught him an appreciation for the arts. So he eventually played college football and baseball, but he also played at the Peabody Conservatory.
Wow.
My daughter, who refused to do sports, only wanted to dance and sing, felt very comfortable here because it's a supportive, kind environment, and she tried sports. She would never do it anywhere else. Turned out to be pretty good. Her claim to fame is she was the captain of the girls' softball team at the Performing Arts High School at LaGuardia, Manhattan.
And was it rare to have any sports at a performing arts high school?
Well, the fact that she was captain was for a kid who never wanted to do it, it tells you how, you know, it opened her up. You know, the camp actually opened her up. It's the kind of place where you could be yourself and everybody celebrates it. Not just accepts it, but celebrates it. We say we celebrate differences at French Woods.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the things I wrote down while I was waiting for you, was that here at camp, odd is in. You know, to be, sometimes the kids worry about being the odd kid out at school, and then they come here, and the odder the better, the odder the more interesting.
Well, I once took a family on a tour, goes back 12 years ago, and they met this little girl who's about 11 years old, and they asked her, why do you love French Wood so much? And she thought for a second, and she said, you know, at home I'm different. But here, everybody's different.
So what does, because to do anything for 30-plus years, you have to have a passion for it. Because you seem to be in an age where you probably don't have to come back and do camp every year, right?
Keeps you young. and there's nothing like working with kids, especially the kids here, because they are so unique. You know, every day is an adventure. Every day is something new. I learn something new every day. And it really does keep you young and keep your mind sharp.
So what does camp do for you personally? How has it impacted your life?
That's a good question. I meet people from all over the world. I think I have really nice relationships with so many people from throughout the United States, around the world. And then you don't realize the little small things you do for a kid that you think is, you know, second nature, part of your job, and how people remind me of what I did, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that I thought, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. And for them, it was like a big deal. It makes you feel really good about doing stuff like this.
So what's the biggest challenge for you each day?
Staying young enough to stay awake all day and keep up with the kids. It's keeping up with everybody. One of the best things we have here is incredible staff. And this year, the staff has been great. The head counselor staff that I work with is outstanding. I mean, they think like I do. So they react to things and take care of things and are proactive the way I would want them to be. So it's made my job the last couple of years a lot easier. When they kind of graduate and grow up, even if they're 30 and 40 and they don't come back, it's going to be tough because that, you know, like Carolyn and you met Rosie and Rachel, I mean, they think like, you know, we all think the same way.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm back in the studio after my summer traveling across the country. But I'm still bringing you a couple more conversations that I had from the road. And today, we're celebrating the performing arts and what it brings to us emotionally, socially, how it helps our mental health. And I'm coming to you from French Woods Festival of Performing Arts, and we're listening to camp director Isaac Baumfeld talk about his experience over over the last 30 plus years working at this camp. And we're also talking to head counselor Carolyn Stock Chapin about her experience of over 17 years with French Woods. And as we wrapped up our conversation, I had to address this idea that going to a summer camp is quite a privileged experience. I mean, these camps are incredibly costly, especially for an entire summer. But maybe, you know, when we think about our mental health, our well-being, the development for our children, that cost becomes insignificant when you think about the priceless experience of being able to feel connected to this community. Because I think a lot about, you know, how hard we work as parents and as teachers to create a world where our children aren't bullied and that they feel celebrated and they feel special. And the reality is, in the greater context of the world, it's tough to have full unlimited acceptance, and that part of our job is to help our children develop the resilience to be able to go out into the harsh world and still feel good enough about themselves that they can kind of take the bullying that comes their way or the disappointments that happen, and to be able to continue on and know that behind them there are people who love and support them for their uniqueness. But, you know, it's a balance. And so to have our children be in a place where they can feel accepted all summer long, it probably inoculates them in some amazing ways for the realities of going back to the public school system or the world in general. And so as we finish our conversation, I talked to Isaac and Carolyn about the costs and benefits of having this unique experience.
What do you say to a parent who says, we can't afford this, or, you know, because you mentioned growing up, it's an expensive summer activity. What do you say to those parents? What does this give to kids that make it worth the investment?
The interesting thing about a lot of parents do save their pennies to do 3 weeks at French Woods, because it's more than just a babysitting service. You know, they get a lot out of it. And we do try to help a lot of parents who can't afford it. So we do our best to help where we can, you know, so... We have kids that can't afford it who do get to come.
So the kids from California, if they were going to come out to French Woods, they can fly out here. You meet them, right, and bring them to camp? And
Yeah. We meet them at the airport. We take them up to camp. We bring them back to the airport. And we have about 100 kids that come every summer from California.
And you come out and do a recruiting tour, right? When does that occur usually?
The end of January, beginning of February. Sometimes it's as late as the end of February, but we go out and we meet with some of the families, and there's some recruiting fairs that we go to, but it's always fun to go out to LA.
What makes French Woods French Woods?
You know, French Woods is a place where you've got everything that, you know, and not every camp does that. You know, some camps you're going together from activity to activity with your bunk, while here you have that independence, you know, we talked about. And so much is offered. And it isn't only about the activities, but, you know, that's a big thing that gets kids to come in the first place. And then they're here, and, yeah, the connections. You know, it's life-changing. It's life-empowering. I was just talking the other day to someone, and we joked, but it's true. Everything comes back to French Woods. Why I moved from one place to another, why I went to a graduate school, why I'm taking, you know, I took a job overseas, all is because of someone I met here at French Woods.
And why she had the kids in February and not any other time.
I got pregnant.
Yeah.
And the camp, one of the camp owners, a family camp, we all had all our children the same week in February so that we could get to camp
and not miss camp while they're pregnant.
Pregnant at the right time, and you know, it's,
camp drives us.
Yeah, it's true.
We are French Woods.
But you know, and what makes a French Woods camper is a kid that is, you know, interested, is diverse. It's interested in exploring many different things, in knowing that they can be reached, you know, at a very high level of maybe something that they do all year, but also can explore and dabble in all kinds of other areas they haven't ever tried yet. You know, it's they're kind kids, they're warm kids, they're kids that there's not bullying, there's, you know, it's kids that really embrace each other for who they are. And maybe it is the arts base or something, but it's a place where you see kids that maybe are having a hard time flourishing anywhere else in the world, and this becomes what they count down to every year. They're counting, you know, when I was a kid, I'd count the time between camp and camp. That was my year, that's what all the kids do here.
We had a parent tell a group of parents that her kid would walk through the halls in school and start singing and dancing, and the big boys would bully him. And she says, when he does it here at French Woods, the big boys harmonize with him.
I'm the greatest star. I am by far. But no one knows. Wait, I'm gonna hear a voice. A silver flute. Bell cheer each toot. Hey, I finished terrific. When I expose it. Now can't you see to look at me that I'm a natural chameleon.
If you're just tuning in, this is Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And this is my last show officially from the road today. Next week, I'll be here to open up the phone lines and have a conversation about all of our summer activities and experiences and getting ready for the school year to begin again, which is hard to believe. I feel like I just started the summer and we're already kind of shifting gears. But today, I honor the performing arts and the way that the performing arts help us to maintain our mental health and our well-being and our just sense of community and connection. And my second conversation took place outside of an actor's housing facility. It's actually very nice condos that are part of the Goodspeed Opera House. This is a historic theater overlooking the Connecticut River in East Haddam, Connecticut. And I was there to visit my very good friend, Rhett Guter, who is stealing the show every day as Conrad Birdie in a newly revised version of Bye Bye Birdie that's been playing there all summer. And it's fun because I have known Rhett for over 8 years. He started at PCPA, and I got to see him there. And then he moved to Utah for a while to do summer series, summer stock at Utah Shakes, and I went and saw him there. And then he moved to Chicago, and he's been performing there for the few years, and we got to see him perform there. And now he's moved his way east. He's in Connecticut and will soon be moving to New York. And he's done incredibly well in this business that rejects way more people than it accepts. And it's been fun to watch him develop his profession. But I've always wondered, how do professional actors maintain their mental health, if they do maintain their mental health, in such a roller coaster up and down career? Because we really only hear about the high-profile celebrities, the ones that seem to fly really high and then at some point flame out in some way. But we really never hear about the vast majority of actors, performers, entertainers who actually build their lives and their careers outside of that constant limelight. But they have their own kind of shining spotlight. They find their own center of success. And so during my time visiting with Rhett, he actually introduced me to a fellow performer, Christine Zabornik, who is also spending the summer stealing the show, playing Mae Peterson in this updated version of Bye Bye Birdie. And she, Christine, well, she's a force. She is a powerful woman, and she's actually finding her greatest success and voice at midlife, in the midlife of her career. And after dedicating a life to performance, she's really feeling the best about where she's at. She has an incredible heart. You can feel it from the minute you start talking to her. And when I mentioned to her that I do this show to help normalize this wide spectrum of mental health and all of the ways that people create their own version of normal, and that we don't often hear about those different versions of normal, she jumped right in and started telling me a story about the power of the performing arts in healing and transforming the lives of those who get to participate, and the way that theater allows the audience to connect to their own lives. So this is Christine Zabornik. No introduction necessary. We just jump right into the meat of the story.
I did 101 Dalmatians with the kids from Newtown, Connecticut 2 years ago. And they, because the kids had come through such a horrendous ordeal, they took out the part where Cruella de Vil kills the dogs for their skins.
Right, which was the whole storyline.
That's the whole storyline. And they made me averse to spots. And, you know, like obsessive compulsive averse to spots. But the kids all came up and said, why did they change it? And I didn't know how to answer that question, you know, because you can't take it. You know, they all knew the real story.
And children do know all the real stories. And it's funny because from a psychotherapy position, it's the secrets we keep from children that mess their heads up, because they know innately what the truth of life is. And then we as parents keep saying, no, it's the stork, or no, it's magic. And it doesn't ultimately help them. And so let's jump it into theater, because I would imagine the intention of that production of 101 Dalmatians was the therapeutic experience of coming together and putting this on. Did it have its therapeutic outcome?
Massive. Mm-hmm. See, that's the thing. And this has its good outcome, too. And all 104 kids were in it, and I was the only adult. And these kids, one of the girls who was in it, I can't say too much, but suffice to say, the first night she couldn't come out. We did four performances. The second night she just came out at the end. The third night she came out at act two. And the fourth night she did the whole thing. And you know, it changed her. It shifted her. Her fear and her terror were helped and lifted.
So what was this? Because I think I read about this production, but the 101 Dalmatians. Can you talk a little bit about how its genesis and how it came to be and where it played?
There's a group there that is trying to build a memorial to the kids of Newtown and the people of Newtown who died. And they started the year before deciding that they were going to build a performing arts school for children instead of a memorial.
I love that.
Yeah. And, like, the idea that if you bring all of the people from maybe the outcasts or the others and bring them all together, theater is the thing that pulls that person together. And maybe this person who they would prefer, I don't use the guy's name, you know, maybe what if he had been a stage manager? What if he had been a part of the group? You know what I mean? I mean, that's a far stretch, but this is the idea behind it. And so they take one adult professional performer and they put them with all the kids who can and want to be a part of this.
And it's interesting because I've been reading through Joseph Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces again. And I got caught in this whole idea of the tragedy comedy, and that, you know, our ancient myths are really steeped in tragedy because life is tragic, and that comedy is the way we cope with the tragedy. And isn't that the essence of theater? Mm-hmm. Was a way of taking the stories of life that are often tragic and giving us all an opportunity to see, oh, I'm not alone. I'm seeing my life unfold, and even Bye-Bye Birdie in some way, even though it's a cartoonish picture of the suburban housewife in the 60s, it was relatable to a lot of people, that they're seeing their life in some way, or maybe they're seeing a life that they don't have and they're thankful that they don't.
Yeah, no, it's complicated, and because of this, it has a new relevance because of how Jen directed it, and I don't know, maybe because of the rewrites, but mostly I think it's because of her direction and her vision has made it relevant in the sense of, like, generations, kids and parents, and how there must be a split. And it's never easy, and it's always painful, and nobody wants it. And that's really what this piece is about. And that's never going to go away.
The navigating of that parent-child dynamic. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, of the celebrity culture and how we idolize that and we lose ourselves into the fad of the time. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX, and my conversation with actress, cabaret singer, entertainer, performer, and one of the stars of this summer's Bye Bye Birdie at the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut, Christine Zbornik. And we continue our conversation. So, Christine, tell me a little bit about prior to coming up here to Goodspeed, some of the things you've done in your professional career. How did you grow your career as an actor in New York?
Okay, I'll give you the Reader's Digest. I got my equity card. You know, if Actors Equity is like the union for actors, and
you have to do a certain amount of work to qualify for that.
Yeah, or get into an equity show, and then you can just buy your card and be a member then. That was how it was. It's slightly different now. So I got that within a year and a half, and it was called An Evening with Joan Crawford, and I played Ethel Merman in it. We made it up through improv, and then it got moved to Off-Broadway, and then it tanked. But that's how I got, like, my first Off-Broadway show, which I was still in my early 20s. And then I didn't get another job for 7 years. And, I mean, I was pounding the pavement, as they say. And so I started doing temp work, and I was getting crazily tense and bitter about it all and just creating more obstacles mentally. But I did what I could. It was tough. And
was that common for most people that you were journeying with?
No. It was weird. Most people that I was journeying with left.
They did. So they gave up.
Mm-hmm. Even though they worked more than I did. And for me, I started studying with a master teacher who I didn't know was a master, but I see now that she was. And her name was Frances Cheney, and she taught the Neighborhood Playhouse Sanford Meisner method of acting. And I got deep into that. And I started working in piano bar, which is really what changed the course of my whole performing thing. Because then I became a singing bartender and waitress. And I did that off and on for 11 years. And that's how I really got my writing chops, working with John Q. Public that walks in off the street, not hand-picked stuff, you know. And I really realized that had I gone right into show after show after show, I wouldn't have developed my writer's voice and my own thing, which is much more significant in my, let's say, my canon of work than doing other people's shows is.
So being a performer is not your primary...
I'm an entertainer.
Okay.
And I act, I sing, I write, and I do comedy.
And what kind of writing do you do? Because I'm jumping off the original question.
I mean, if you were going to define it, would be stand-up-y meets maybe Bette Midler-y. You know what I mean?
You mentioned Ethel Merman was a character you played earlier. So I'm getting the sense that you have that larger-than-life persona that lives in you.
Yeah.
And wants to be expressed through. So did you do Bette Midler type of... I guess her work is not cabaret, but...
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, no, it's cabaret.
Okay, thank you.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I did. I've done probably, over 100 shows of sorts. I worked with a lot of drag queens. Varla Jean Merman, Coco Peru, Tommy Femiez, Judy Garland. I was like their second banana. Mm-hmm. I wrote my own shows, Zabornik in a Trunk, Zabornik in a Nutshell, Ball of Confusion. These were my various shows. And I would put them up as I could afford to with a piano player. And I just take mostly... I will do some original writing. Jason Robert Brown, who's a composer, before he was...
He did 13, right?
Right.
And he's from French Woods.
Oh, yes, he is. That's right. He and I met in piano bar, and we wrote several pieces, and he wrote several pieces for me. So I would plug his stuff into my acts, things of that nature. But mostly I would take, standard known songs like Girl from Ipanema, Memory from Cats, and twist them into a pretzel of my thinking.
We're sitting again on the porch here at Actors Housing for Goodspeed Opera House. And if it's a very gypsy-esque mm-hmm. lifestyle. So do you find yourself on the road in gigging? So what is that like? How do you build a life, a normal, around okay. being so transient? And one day you're writing a cabaret, and then you're up in Connecticut doing Bye Bye Birdie, and then I imagine you're, auditioning for that. How do you build a normal in that?
Well, okay. I'm going to take that normal concept and I'm going to call it functional.
Okay.
And I do that because normal feels a little bit damped down to me, and functional feels like anything can happen as long as it's working and you're not hurting someone else. So functionality occurs for me through extreme self-analysis, journaling, therapy, spiritual searching, yoga, meditation. Okay, so that's the balance to all the insanity of traveling, working on the road. You know, I was on the road with 9 to 5. We trapped for a year, the musical of that.
Wicked. And what is that like? What is your day-to-day like?
You're always looking for a Whole Foods, for the yoga, and for the laundry.
Okay.
That is the reality.
Okay.
Now, some people are better at that than me and more like, ooh, here we are in X city. And most cities now in America are a real bummer. Most downtowns are dead, especially in the South. Great cities are Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, unexpectedly. There's more. Baltimore blew my mind with its rawness. We were there when the riots started. I did Wicked for 9 months also. That was a better tour for me because we were in places longer and you could relax and start to be a part of the community or feel like you could go to a museum or, you know, be there. Mm-hmm. Normally, with 9 to 5, we were going every week to a new city or every other week. And so, like, it's exhausting. But, boy, do people respond. Because you're coming to their town, and it's, like, massively important to people to be seeing live theater and be getting this live, I'm here, you're here, this is it, it's ephemeral, it'll never be here again like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's like you're bringing also Broadway to these towns where people will never get to come into the city. So I imagine that's pretty magic. But I guess because, you know, we're older women.
Yeah.
And so we had, you know, I'm sure that you had certain ideas of what your life would look like when you got to, you know, midlife. Mm-hmm. Is it what you expected? And again, aside from trying to find that balance of the spiritual and the grounding, the meditation, is the rest of it what you expected? Or you know, how do you... Is there a time, I don't know how to ask the question, is there a time that you see yourself sitting on a rocking chair and not, you know, bouncing show to show? Or is this the normal you quested for when you were 20?
This is not the normal I quested for. And when I was 20, I imagined at the turn of the century, which was 2000, mm-hmm. as we know, I was going to be, in my mind, I remember being in high school thinking, oh, I'm going to be 40. I'll probably be really fat and still here in Cleveland. And I'm not fat. I still struggle with weight and body image, but I'm much younger in appearance and thought and body than I thought I would be at this age. I'm going to be 59 in August. And there was a thing that flew on me,
a bug.
And I believe I intend to die with my boots on, but I don't say that negatively. Mm-hmm. Being a performer is part of who I am. And I don't always like it, even. And sometimes I've tried to quit several times, but like Al Pacino in Godfather 3, they keep pulling me back in, you know. That's such a horrible movie, but that's such a great quote. Because show business is like that for me, and I wanted to get away from it. And now I'm starting to realize, like, oh, I could play Mae Peterson and Aunt Eller and all these older characters. I'm in this different category.
Like, all of a sudden, you've aged up into some really fun roles.
And I'm not struggling anymore like I was.
Hmm. And to get the work or just personally?
Both.
Okay.
And I see the world in a much darker place and me in a much brighter place, and it's weird, and I don't know quite how to make peace with that, but I know that it's true. Like, if I had to be 20 now in this world, I don't know what the hell I'd do. But, God, there's no one like me now. I haven't had any facial work. But I'm strong and healthy and vital. And so I'm so marketable, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. And that's completely unexpected. I thought I'd be going down. I keep moving up.
Well, I mean, because you talked about at the beginning, you had that 7 years where nothing came to you. And mm-hmm. so you probably saw that as the trajectory of it. Mm-hmm. When did it turn the corner? Because you kind of started doing the cabaret and writing your own shows and picking up theater, I would imagine, along the way.
Yes, exactly.
So you hit 50, and I've said this a million times because I'm 55, that 50 was the turning point mm-hmm. for me also in confidence and, you know, feeling settled. So maybe that's just the beauty of midlife for women. I don't know, in this day and age.
Now, because we don't have to be chattel anymore, you know, and we really don't have to be. You know, I've had very few relationships. I'm, you know, I suppose I'm heterosexual, but I'm mostly not very sexual because I'm just focused on work and, you know, friendships and the stuff that I do. And sometimes it gets isolating. But in answer to your question, I had my first Broadway show when I was 50.
Really?
Yeah.
When? What was it?
A Catered Affair. Didn't last very long, but what a huge thing that was. The light went off and I got it totally. I was like, oh, I see where this is going, because I had gotten Mamma Mia before that, and a friend of mine who I was working in the bars with said, you're just going to keep getting show after show now. And I was like, Lenny, this is a one-shot deal. And he was right. He said, it's going to happen for you now in that way that everybody wished had happened for you previously, you know. Mm-hmm.
Is it sweeter hitting at 50 than if it hits you at 25?
Does anybody ever know what it is when it's happening? I don't think so. I don't think you can ever fully really be present in what's happening. I can't. Maybe the Dalai Lama can. But for me, there's always a past and there's always a future going on while I'm here. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's probably a lot. I have a lot more sobriety about what it truly is and what it can really do for me, mm-hmm. you know, what it really represents.
It's the testament to why I'm having these conversations is all the different ways that we as humans find our normal or find mm-hmm. our mental health and well-being in our lives. And clearly you've found your grounding in a life of theater, starting as a young girl in Cleveland, jumping to New York City at, what, probably 20 years old?
19
years old, 1977. Living in a little apartment, what was this world giving to you? What did the actor's life give to you?
Self-expression and my desire that I still grapple with to be the center of attention or to be loved or to be noticed in an unconditional way. You know, childhood things that are unfulfilled often get put into that arena, and you know that you can't get that fulfilled, but it still was a motivating factor. I think that it's part of my drive, mm-hmm. is that deep desire to be heard, understood, and to express my thoughts and my abilities, and to also make people laugh, which I do naturally and I sort of take for granted, but I realize now that that's a big part of why people like me when I perform. It's kind of, I'm funny.
You're magnetic.
I wanna see a show tune. A show tune. That's what sets me aglow. A show tune. A show tune. So Mame and Dolly, hello. Oh, you can cry a lot and sigh a lot, but nothing helps the blues to say goodbye a lot like a show tune from the Broadway musical show.
You're listening to Christine Zabornik being accompanied by Seth Rudesky and singing a song that was written for her by Jason Robert Brown that she mentioned earlier in the conversation. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And we're in the middle of a conversation with the force that is Christine Zabornik, talking about her life in the theater and her world as she's created it professionally starting at the age of 19. And
I think it's important to have these conversations to talk to people who maybe aren't going to be, who knows where Christine will end up, but aren't currently in the center of the universe, but creating a life that is really meaningful and making a lot of people happy and finding their authentic voice and being true to themselves and just finding out that we get better and better and better as life carries on. And so we're doing things a little differently today. We're not taking phone calls, but you can always be part of the conversation by joining us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us in pictures on Instagram at The Reluctant Therapist. And if you've missed any of this conversation today or would like to listen to previous shows, you can find us at kcbx.org. And you can also podcast our shows through iTunes or the app on your device. You can subscribe and get all of the shows as they come up. So as we go into our last segment with Christine, we spent a little bit of time talking about this beauty of aging and what is coming down the road for her. And we also talk about a project that she's been working on to address our current cultural crisis when it comes to mental health. We'll finish off hearing a little bit more of Christine singing with Seth Rudesky.
The crime's still here, but all I need's a verse or two of I still here from a show to from a Broadway musical show.
How have the roles changed, the characters? Who do you get to play? How has that changed in your 50s?
Well, okay, if I were coming from having played lead roles, I would feel bummed out.
Oh, you would?
Yeah, because some people who I know who won, like, Tonys, who were, like, not typical leading women, now have to play these characters like me. I'm in that same category with them all now. And to me, this is like, I have one song and all the killer comedy scenes. I don't want the whole show on my shoulders. People say, oh, you're the perfect Mama Rose and Gypsy, you ought to be. It's like, I'm almost 60. I don't want to sing 8 songs at 10 all night long for, you know, $625 a week take home. No, I don't want to. I can write my own act and do 5-11 o'clock numbers and then say what I want to say. You know, so to me, this is where it's at.
You're doing Bye Bye Birdie. What happens for you next? Like, do you go, are you still at the stage where you're thinking, oh, it's nice I'm here, I can sit, but I've got to be auditioning, or I have to, like, do you line out work for the next year? How do you work this life?
You are killing me, because just this morning I woke up at 6:15, too early, and I wrote to my agent, it's time for Grandma to think about another gig. Get on board. Here's some ideas. No, I have no prospects for work.
And has that been the story of the acting life?
Yeah.
And does that cause anxiety?
Horrible. Yeah. I have to have, okay, I was raised by atheists, and I have to develop this thing of, like, have faith in what you saw happen and know that can be the course of things. You know, but there is no tangible proof that I'll ever work again.
Right. And is that what drives actors in general? Yeah. That you never are there. You're always auditioning for the next show. Like, is there ever a moment where you're there?
Oh, I'm. That is my whole quest here, is to be here.
Okay.
And that is something I keep redirecting my anxiety toward, being here. Mm-hmm. Because this is it.
When we started this conversation, you had mentioned something you were writing.
Oh, well, I'm writing 10,000 things, and
is it not always music based? I mean, is it?
No, this isn't. This is an idea for a series.
Okay,
and I got it when I went to my brother's second wedding, and there were 40 people there. Let's say 40, maybe 80, I don't know, let's say, you know. And two of them had kids who were schizophrenic and on psychotropic drugs. And I, you know, and I'd been to high school with them, and I was like, this is not a good average, you know. And I had this idea to write what I would like to be a television, an ongoing, like, done on HBO or Amazon or Netflix or something like that, called Our Psychotic Children, which is about a therapist who, let's say, would be you, who is in therapy with families and children and not wanting to use psychotropic drugs, and then pitting that person with, and it would be a comedy, a black comedy, with the therapist who wants to do it, and the kids, so that you could, like, really get down and dirty with what it is going on in a child, would be puppets. Because I don't want to soft sell the trauma of childhood existence, which is largely traumatic for a lot of people, and especially people who are going for help. And so I wouldn't want to see kids go through that. Mm-hmm. So I would have adults as puppets, being the children.
Almost like the way Charlie Brown's parents exist.
Exactly. Exactly. So that, you know, sexual abuse and parental stuff could be talked about openly, like, in a real way. Mm-hmm. And just the idea that the idea that a kid kind of is a puppet.
Well, because they're at the mercy of the adults who change, who get to direct their life, which is why medications have always horrified me, because we as the adults then are choosing the direction of the child's life without them having any say, because developmentally we don't know what the long-term effects of these drugs are. And I love the idea of this theory, of this series, because if you had the battle of the one lone therapist, who I tend to feel like I am, mm-hmm. Saying, don't you realize that the emperor is naked? You know, no one's getting better. You're medicating all these people and everyone's just getting worse. Why am I the only one seeing that? And we just get deeper and deeper into the no one's getting better. And how would it be, instead of medicating children to flatten them, if we worked with the trauma and we built resilience and coping mechanisms? Because the truth of the matter is, everyone is traumatized. No one goes through life without trauma. So wouldn't we be better off helping people cope with the facts of existence instead of trying to flatten their affect?
I agree. I mean, would any of these people, explorers, Mozart, scientists, if they'd been medicated, would they have discovered anything? Would they have been driven to take all of that energy? Because it's essentially energy. Mm-hmm. And put it into something really great for everybody, you know? And music and creativity is so much an expression of trauma redirected.
Yeah, so if we took children and instead of sending them to therapy, we sent them to theater camp, how much better that would be.
I don't know, but I think it wouldn't hurt.
And this has been A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can find out more about Frenchwood Festival at their French Woods Festival at their website. And also you can see Christine if you look on YouTube. She has quite a few little songs and numbers for you to check out. And we'll have these links on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can always email me to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com and catch all of our shows at kcbx.org or podcast. And I'll be back next week to open up the phone line so we can hear from you and share our summer stories. Until then, thank you for supporting the show, and thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Talent laugh. They'll bend in half. Did you ever hear a story about the traveling salesman? 1,000 jokes stick around for the jokes.
Sure.
1,000 faces, I reiterate. When you're gifted, then you're gifted. These are facts. I got no axe to grind. In all of the world, so far, I'm the greatest star.
No autographs, please.
Huh? What did she say?
You think beautiful girls are going to stay a star forever?
Yeah.
I should say not. Any minute now, they're going to be out. Finished!